May I have your attention, please? That's because it's time to launch another episode of The Far Middle. And I, Nick Deolius, I'm happy to be serving as your host for this half hour or so of a journey. The episode this week is going to drill down into three key topics: by the numbers, through the years, and through a lens of consistency, or in some unfortunate instances, inconsistency. I think you're going to enjoy this storyboard for episode 151, and it goes without saying we will be tying all these together with our now famous connections. So if the themes of this episode are going to be by the numbers and through the years and through the lens of consistency, then we've got a perfect sports dedication subject. And we're, again, going for something that transcends sport, so that it would be of interest to all constant listeners, not just the sports fans among us. And that dedication this week, it intrigues for two contrasting reasons. Virtually no one, including sports fans, will have heard of our dedication subject, this individual's name. Yet virtually everyone, including those who don't follow sport, will know what he created. The name, let's get with the name first. It is Bill Wink Winkenbach. Who? Exactly. The what he created is fantasy football and its subsequent offspring of fantasy baseball. Fantasy football, that addictive statistics and data-driven competition enabling ordinary fans to become owners and general managers of their own teams, it was invented back in 1962, over 60 years ago, by our dedication person, Bill Wink Winkenbach. Now, Wink knew football because he was a minority owner for the Oakland Raiders back during the AFL days before the merger with the NFL. And Winkenbach dreamed up the idea of what would become a craze, along with another team employee and an Oakland sports reporter, at a New York City hotel during a Raiders road trip. Before you knew it, in August 1963, the first draft of the, get the name of this league, the Greater Oakland Professional Pigskin Procrastinators League, the GOPPPL, was held in Wink's home. Now, the Greater Oakland Professional Pigskin Procrastinators League, it had a mission statement. Its original charter stated as follows: it is felt that this tournament will automatically increase closer coverage of daily happenings in professional football. The league continues to this day, with the current commissioner serving since 1974. How cool was that? Okay, guess who the first overall pick was in that 1963 fantasy draft? He's a Hall of Famer and a Western Pennsylvania native. His name's George Blanda. That trivia should impress the in crowd at your next gathering, so feel free to give it a go. And if someone guesses George Blanda, they may indeed be a fellow constant listener of The Far Middle, so it might be an easy way to identify them. Now, what were the rules for that first fantasy draft? AFL or NFL players could be selected, and points were awarded for touchdowns and field goals. In fact, probably the catalyst for creating the fantasy league was the opportunity to imagine stars in the NFL going up against stars in the AFL, which didn't happen on the field back then. And by the late 1960s, the first public fantasy league was established at an Oakland bar. And by the late 1980s, more than a million people played fantasy football, which was about the time I first started playing. And that number has skyrocketed to tens of millions today. A recent estimate that I saw counts 30 million Americans as fantasy football participants. The internet, smartphones, you know, they made joining and organizing leagues easier, of course, while satellite TV packages, those types of things, they allow fans to watch more of their players live. And you can gamble on players, in case you haven't noticed, not just teams or games, so that stokes fantasy interest further. But above all, fantasy football, which has become a multi-billion dollar, in fact, an $11 billion per year, to be exact, industry, has greatly intensified fan interest. It's altered the way millions of people watch the sport. As individual players in less high-profile games, they're often followed as intensely as the favorite team in the big games. Is that for better or for worse? I am not sure. What do you think? Now, I mentioned I participated in fantasy leagues back in the late 80s and early 90s. It's because I love data, love sports, and it was a great excuse to hang out with friends. But I stopped doing the fantasy sports thing years ago, and it coincided with my diminishing interest in watching and attending contemporary sporting events. It's all too different for my taste these days. I guess sports were always about business, but winning It used to correlate to motivation and the money. Now it's all business all the time, and the money doesn't seem to correlate to the team, city, or winning necessarily. That's not for me, but if it's still for you, enjoy. And chances are that one of the ways you enjoy the modern pro sports game is through fantasy leagues that got their start with a 1962 brainstorming session led by the father of fantasy, Wink Winkenbach. That was Fantasy Football by the Numbers and through the years. Let's jump to our first connection by discussing the immigration crisis by the numbers and through the years up to today. Now, being part of a family who got its start here in America through immigration, I always lean toward being pro-immigration, but under, of course, reasonably defined sets of rules and criteria. And that is far from what we have today, unfortunately. When I had a chance to delve into the recent data, it was sobering and frightening. And I wanted to share the data with you. Special thanks to the Center for Immigration Studies, where I was able to find much of the data that we'll discuss here. But first, through the years. In 1960, it was the Eisenhower administration that first began to tally the number of foreign nationals who were apprehended or encountered at the border, and specifically on our southern border with Mexico. Since 1960, those data have been published and monitored over the years, and today the data sit at a level that we've never experienced before. Our Border Patrol has been hit with 7.6 million humans crossing the border in 3 years' time. That's an all-time record. And by the way, over those 3 years, each year breaks the prior year's record. So basically, the historic problem continues to grow. And since the start of 2021, the number of the 7.6 million encountered by the Border Patrol that's been allowed to stay in the United States is over 5 million. And more worrisome is the realization that today the percentage of those allowed to stay is estimated to be close to, if not at, 100%. Daily apprehensions, as the Border Patrol defines it, they're somewhere around 15,000 per day. And these numbers, of course, do not include those who entered the country illegally without being apprehended. Those who sneak in undetected, they're often referred to as gotaways. And although the Border Patrol doesn't provide public official estimates of that category, experts estimate the number to be around 2 million more over the past 3 years. So that means over the past 3 years, there's a total of about 10 million unauthorized, undocumented immigrants that have entered the United States, which, by the way, is about the size of New York and Houston combined. It's amazing. Here's an interesting fact you may have not known. Almost half of those 10 million unauthorized entrants coming from countries of origin, they are not coming from Mexico or Central America. And that's not what most Americans think. More than a million have been ordered by the courts to be deported, but they remain in America nonetheless. And experts estimate Mexican criminal cartels, they are now making more money from cross-border human smuggling operations than from drug smuggling. That's a dubious first. The cartels, by the way, they receive around $10,000 per human trafficked. That's the immigration crisis by the numbers and through the years. And that is the result, not of incompetence, but of consciously designed policies and conscious effort to not enforce existing policies. Yeah, this crisis is largely by design. How do we manage this without overwhelming schools and hospitals? How do we pay for this? Which, by the way, the costs are said to exceed $400 billion for just the basics. And what message and example does it send and set? Where's the media, by the way, reporting on all this? There's a set of questions that we're not going to have the answers for in this episode of The Far Middle. By the numbers on the immigration crisis should freak all of us out. Let's make a connection to a historical by the numbers that is just as surprising and shocking. Now, you might sense if you've listened to The Far Middle for a while that I'm a bit of a student of World War II history. I've read, listened, and wrote on it for years. But here's something I never understood until recently, and it provides a view into the mindset of what the Ukraine is up against with Russia by the numbers. In World War II, some experts estimate that the USSR killed up to 900,000 of its own soldiers. That's more than the United States and the UK lost in battles together over the entire war. I came across a ghastly breakdown of that ghastly tally. Over 280,000 were sentenced to execution, with over 157,000 officially executed. So that's more than half executed after sentencing. And by the way, top brass were not excluded from the Stalin killing spree back in the old Soviet state during World War II. In the first year of the war, which was a disaster for the USSR, the Soviets arrested 72 of its generals and six admirals. Many of them were executed and many died in camps or prisons. But it does not count those who were killed by the NKVD, which was the state security police, when they were retreating or deserting in battles. There was an infamous and special law issued by Stalin known as the Not One Step Backward Law. And Soviets toward the rear, they were instructed to shoot those on the front line who retreated after an unsuccessful attack. And those attacks were unsuccessful mostly because Soviet troops were poorly equipped and had almost no training. Experts pegged that tally north of 150,000 killed. Many experts believe the Not One Step Backward mandate had another useful purpose. It was a convenient way to get rid of other non-Russian ethnicities. General Zhukov, who is sort of the undisputed greatest Soviet general of the war, said about Ukrainians and the Not One Step Backward edict that the more of them that die, the less we will have to throw to concentration camps. By the way, Ukrainians were about 30% of the Soviet troops in World War II. Again, no one knows for sure exactly how many Soviet troops were killed by their own government or by their own troops. But the low end says at least 300,000, and the high end estimates the tab at 900,000. It's an amazing range no matter where you land inside of it. And for perspective, the United States suffered around 300,000 combat deaths through all of World War II. So Stalin killed more of his own than the Japanese and Germans killed of Americans. Yes, Russians, they wage total and brutal war. They always have and maybe always will. Napoleon learned that the hard way. Hitler learned it the hard way. Even the Mongols eventually learned it the hard way. And now the world is learning it again the hard way when we see these meat waves, as they're called, unleashed on Ukrainian towns and strong points. Look back on those three connections that we discussed so far this episode. We had fantasy sports, the immigration crisis at the border, and Soviet troops dying at the hands of their own government in World War II. Besides all being rooted in data, all three share another attribute, the importance of consistency and the danger of inconsistency. Now, one of the beauties of fantasy sports, for example, it's scoring consistently across the board or across the gridiron in the case of fantasy football. If you suddenly arbitrarily change the scoring player to player, the entire concept of fantasy football collapses. And perhaps the biggest problem and root cause with our immigration crisis at the border is that rules are no longer rules. Specifically, rules don't apply to everyone the same way. That's a chaos creator. And then the same is true with the Soviets in World War II when it came to brutalizing their own troops. I've read, and some experts have surmised, that Stalin, he thought long and hard about leaving Moscow when the Germans were approaching. And that sounds like more than one step backward, yet he didn't hold himself accountable to his own edicts that he insisted everybody else within the army and nation adhere to. Now, we have a connection of contrasting inconsistencies in the political arena that is in the news and will likely continue to be in the news up until the November election. And don't read this as pro-Trump or anti-Biden. You're fully capable of making your own minds up as the election approaches. But do read it as emphasizing the danger of inconsistent application of law and rule. That's something that should greatly concern you because it hurts America. But then again, what I'm about to discuss sort of pales next to other inconsistencies in our history, like slavery and women not having the right to vote until the 1920s. But I digress. Back to the connection at hand. Let's take President A, Trump, who's facing legal consequences for removing confidential files over 2 years and keeping those files at a private residence location. Now, those looking to prosecute say there are laws against that, and those rules have good reason for being. Fair enough, especially when talking about national security. I'm down with that. But then the same rules, they get ignored when it comes to a different individual, this time President B, Biden. He removes sensitive files over 30 years, and he had them stored not in one location, but in several, including in that famous garage. And President Biden committed these acts when he was a senator and vice president, Trump did it while president, and thus he had the authority to classify or declassify documents as he wished. So President Biden never reported the potential crime over 3 decades and did so only after President Trump was charged. President Biden admitted on tape years ago that he possessed classified files but never reported it. When a nation loses its consistency in the application of law, it's going to lose credibility, and it creates an incentive to not follow the law. It also creates sort of a tit-for-tat retaliatory political environment that feeds upon itself, starts to look like a banana republic. Rules are rules. When you break them, account for them. When you enforce them, do so consistently. To do otherwise is asking for trouble, both politically and culturally, and I am not down with that. Hey, let's jump to a connection talking about something I am absolutely in favor of, and it involves, of all things, the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, and its sections that look to jumpstart the hydrogen economy. Now, hydrogen is an opportunity that, if done right, combines environmental benefits and legacy domestic energy opportunities in regions like Appalachia and private sector labor unions like the building trades and private sector capital investment. It brings all those things together. It's a rare chance for government policy to do something constructive. In a recent op-ed, which I provided the link to on this episode of the Far Middle Summary that hopefully you saw when I posted it, it highlights the once-in-a-generation opportunity staring us in the face. Now, this op-ed was penned by a trio of leaders in Western Pennsylvania, and the opportunity they highlight extends way beyond this region. So the three authors were Matt Smith, who's the chief growth officer at the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. The second was Darren Kelly. He's the president of the Allegheny Fayette Central Labor Council of the AFL-CIO. And the third author was Greg Bernarding. He's the executive business manager of the Western Pennsylvania Building and Construction Trades Council. Now, what they're advocating for is going to change countless lives for the better. They rightly see the IRA's hydrogen and energy transition sections as being a perfect fit for places like Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania and Appalachia to become a beacon of transformation primed to redefine America's cleaner energy future. That's how they put it. And I love the way they put it. The authors point out that President Biden's plan to tackle climate change, if you look at the details, demands swift economy-wide decarbonization. But it's got to be done in a way that creates and preserves good-paying jobs, including union jobs. And it should boost resilience with both economic and environmental improvements that everybody says that they want and that we all indeed need. So these are challenges, the doers that you find in places like Pittsburgh, Western PA, and Appalachia that we are wired to solve. And America's middle class and the blue-collar workers out there and the trades, they've done this before and they're ready to do it again. Reading through this op-ed, it reminds us, I think, that hydrogen can check all of these boxes where other options, say wind, solar, batteries, they're going to only check some of the boxes, if any. Hydrogen's widely recognized as the most effective way to reduce emissions from industrial sectors like steel and transportation, cement, various manufacturing industries. And then Pittsburgh and Appalachia, that set of regions or that region itself can be the epicenter of such an effort. No doubt about it, if it's done right, I know it's a big if, but if it's done right, this can drive a legitimate, not a pretend, energy transition. And as we've discussed on this podcast, far too many of these energy transition efforts are myths and pretend. They're not based in science and fact. Now, why does this hydrogen economy and the IRA provisions that speak to it, why does it have such great potential? Because it just so happens that Pennsylvania's distinctive hydrogen opportunity includes an issue that's uniquely Appalachian, and that is with respect to fugitive coal mine methane, or CMM, emissions. Now, coal mine methane, it's a widespread problem. It accounts for roughly 10% of U.S. methane emissions, and it contributes to 13% of industrial sector emissions in places like Pennsylvania. And coal mines, they continue to emit methane even after they're inactive, and there's really no sort of set of standards, and there's certainly not a strong economic case for capturing fugitive coal mine methane. So it's both a challenge and an opportunity. It depends on how you approach it. Coal mine methane represents a key opportunity, if you look at it in that lens, to develop a viable path to clean hydrogen at a scale that's necessary to decarbonize the regions highly concentrated and hard to abate industrial activity. So coal mine methane can be the feedstock to hydrogen processes in sort of Appalachia's industrial and manufacturing sectors to help decarbonize. And if it's properly enabled and maximized under the Inflation Reduction Act, coal mine methane-based hydrogen production, it'll be able to create, and this is in the op-ed, nearly 700,000 jobs, 700,000 jobs in the Pittsburgh region over the next two decades, and it would inject over $200 billion into the regional economy with investment. The authors in this op-ed identified over 30 unique projects, each with the potential to create close to 20,000 jobs per project. Wow. However, and there is a however, these projects, they can only happen with the Treasury Department properly recognizing the climate positive impacts of coal mine methane abatement and the beneficial use of that fugitive coal mine methane. It's simply, by the way, what the law, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, says should happen. It's the intent of the law. It's what the law says should happen. But it does require the bureaucrat at the Treasury Department to follow it when it issues guidance on what the law is going to do. And therein, constant listeners, lies the danger. Because the key to realizing these benefits, it requires that Inflation Reduction Act being implemented and executed the way it was intended to be by Congress. The law passed by Congress and signed by the president, it has to be managed by the bureaucrat consistent with what the law says. And if you listen to this podcast long enough, you know that's always a problem with today's administrative state. Administrative state tends to go rogue and do its own thing in conflict with the law. So the fear is that entities like the Treasury Department is going to issue guidance on how the law should be interpreted, and it's going to unilaterally decide to subjectively apply overly restrictive measures for the IRA's hydrogen production tax credit that could make or break the ability of a region like Appalachia and things like coal mine methane abatement to lead the clean hydrogen economy. Now, they can't counter what the law says and what it intended. That's not how the Constitution works, but you know well enough by now that it can and does happen far too often. So without the full 45V hydrogen production tax credits that the IRA specifies, fugitive methane would continue to be emitted into the atmosphere. That's not good. And the viable hydrogen production paths, they're not going to be available to this highly concentrated, hard-to-abate industries like steel manufacturing, cement, et cetera, that you find in Appalachia and beyond. None of that would be good. So if the end goal is to achieve meaningful emission reductions while boosting competitiveness and preserving those good-paying blue-collar jobs, hey, we're going to need policies that unlock this potential, not hinder it by the bureaucrat arbitrarily dictating based on ideology and not science and math, or the law, which feedstocks or projects qualify for funding and which don't. Yeah, we need an objective approach that's consistent with the Inflation Reduction Act's technology agnostic intent and one that incentivizes cutting new and current emission sources. It's simple and it's rational, and those authors did a great job summarizing up the opportunity. So the Treasury Department, what's it need to do? It needs to finalize 45V hydrogen production tax credits within the IRA that's consistent with what the law intended, and that will facilitate a significant climate positive set of actions and impacts when it comes to fugitive methane's beneficial use. If you do that, it aligns with the original congressional intent, and it also aligns with President Biden's signature on the IRA, and it follows the process defined by the good old Constitution. What a thought. So I had to share that op-ed with you. Again, give it a read. It's a great sort of summary document. It touches on so many far middle themes: energy policy, climate policy, doers, the administrative state, and so on. The IRA, hydrogen economy, Appalachia, coal mine methane, chock full of core themes for sure. And thank goodness there are still leaders like Smith, Kelly, and Bernarding. It might sound like a law firm, but it's actually a team of leaders. Fulfilling potential and promise, it shifts us into our final connection for this episode, an example where the potential and promise, they are never realized for over a century of failure with, of all things, electric vehicles. Now, the history of the electric vehicle spans a century. So in many ways, it's not innovative tech, it's actually old tech. And that century of history, it's stocked with hype that never, ever came to be. You think I'm exaggerating? Check out this timeline, and I want to especially thank my friend and energy journalist Robert Bryce for some of the data points here. In 1901, the LA Times declared, "The electric automobile will quickly and easily take precedent over all other types of motor vehicles. If the claims which Mr. Edison makes for his new battery be not overstated, there is not much doubt that it will make a fortune for somebody." Well, LA Times was wrong. But a decade later, in 1911, here comes the New York Times, and it said that the electric car has long been recognized as the ideal solution because it is cleaner and quieter and much more economical. Not yet. In 1915, the Washington Post, we went LA Times, New York Times, now the Washington Post, they wrote that prices on electric cars will continue to drop until they are within reach of the average family. We're still trying to reach that point 100 plus years later. In 1959, the New York Times was back at it again. They opined that the old electric may be the car of tomorrow. The story said that EVs were making a comeback because gasoline is expensive today, principally because it is so heavily taxed, while electricity is far cheaper. Yeah, I don't think so. In 1967, the LA Times again. Remember AMC, that car company AMC? I think it was acquired ultimately by Chrysler. But AMC reportedly in 67, the LA Times said, was on the verge of producing an electric car with a lithium battery that would be greater than the energy density of modern lithium-ion batteries. The AMC backers back in 1967 said, "We don't see a major obstacle in technology. It's just a matter of time." Well, we're still waiting, I suppose. In 1979, the WashPo said General Motors achieved a breakthrough in batteries that makes electric cars commercially practical. GM continues to lose vast fortunes on EVs to this day. Then in 2014, a few years ago, a Stanford-based lecturer, Tony Seba, said, "By 2025, gasoline engine cars will be unable to compete with electric vehicles." He continued on claiming that internal combustion engine vehicles are toast. I think that's the term that he used. EVs have a better chance of being toast in 2025, Tony, than internal combustion engine vehicles. Yeah, over 100 years of EVs, over 100 years of laughingly wrong predictions, over a century of failed promises, and over a century of billions of dollars of losses. EVs by the numbers and through the years, through a consistent lens. Hey, let's wrap knowing that on the far middle, we've got 151 weeks now of delivering on promises, and we're going to make it 152 weeks soon enough.